away we go. Hello, everybody. We are off and running on our midweek edition. It's Wednesday, October the 4th, 2023. I'm Bill Buckmaster. Tom Fairbanks, engineering and producing our program on the other side of the glass. Tom, I think I'll have to transition from shorts to sweatpants. The morning, kind of chilly when I went out to do the morning watering. Mid-50s.
I have seen people wearing sweaters and light jackets in the early morning.
This
is our transition phase.
We are anxious for the transition. I know I am. Never been so anxious in my life. Green Things, Zocalo Village, have the naming rights to the KVOI studio during the Buckmaster Show. KVOI, Tucson's trusted voice for news and talk. We have our worldwide live listening. That means if you are near a computer, you can hear thebuckmastershow.com anywhere in the world. The Buckmaster Show live line for the telephone interviews presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Let's go now to the Ward 6 Tucson City Council offices of Democrat Steve Kasachek. Steve, how you doing?
Doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, hanging in there. I'm so sorry to hear about the death of your brother, Pete. My condolences to you and your family.
Well, I appreciate that. You are walking through the same sort of emotional minefield.
Yep.
We are planning an event with a group called Friends of Aphasia for December 17th at the Loft. It'll be a screening of Nightmare Before Christmas. Pete was the director of photography and a special effects coordinator on that film, and actually was nominated for an Oscar.
Wow!
Sort of the backstory for that show. For the sort of backstory on that was that all the Tim Burton films, they build the scenes, they build the puppets, and they do the animation one frame at a time. So, for instance, a 30 second scene can take 2 or 3 days to shoot. So they were still doing it that way back then. That was the first year that a computer-driven animation process was used, and so they were competing against Jurassic Park for the Oscar. And Jurassic Park won the Oscar. Two things to that. Number one, the guys on the on Nightmare were really up, really mad because they say, we do it. We don't sit in front of a computer screen and create it that way. Secondly, Pete had turned down a job to go work for Jurassic because he wanted to keep doing it hands-on.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a neat kind of confluence of, the history and the moving forward. But I hope people carve out some time on the 17th of December to come and watch Nightmare, educate themselves on aphasia. It's a very tough disease. It debilitates you over time, and to the point that you can not speak, you can't understand what's being spoken to you, or just take care of your own creature comforts. And
wow.
It's cruel.
Very sorry, Steve. I don't know much about aphasia, but it sounds like it's a real problem. So,
well, back in the day, maybe when we weren't living as long, our grandparents, they didn't deal with dementia, and it's sort of our thing now. And we all know somebody who's got it. And what I said to Pete's wife in the last month or so of his life was, if Pete could rewind this tape and look at what's going on right now, inability to communicate, inability to walk or do any of the stuff that we take for granted, he would say, I want no part of that.
Yeah.
And most of us would.
Yeah.
But our end-of-life decisions, we treat our pets with more dignity than we treat our loved ones. And I have worked with a company called Compassion and Choices before about end-of-life options. State of Arizona is way behind on what we're allowed to do. So that's a conversation I think we really need to advance, given the fact that everybody knows somebody with dementia, and it's the last few years are really cruel.
Yes, indeed. Steve Kasachek, what's this about this unauthorized tree clearing in the area of Mountain and Fort Lowell? 75 trees were felled. Steve, what was the intent here?
Well, so there is a neighborhood association over in the Mountain and Fort Lowell area, And this is a wash called Navajo Wash. They have had some homeless encampments over there in and among the tree grove that was cut down. Some of the neighbors took it upon themselves to, in air quotes, solve that homeless problem by cutting down the trees. It's right now the count is about 75. And they haven't, that by doing that, number one, there's a possible criminal sanction coming their way. It is being investigated by the city attorney and the police department right now. What they've also done is they have effectively a tree grove that many of their own neighbors had planted and had been nurturing. Literally, they did nothing to solve the homeless issue. They did nothing to take care of the people's needs who are there or offer them services. All they did was expose them and cause them to move to another area.
Wow.
Now, I will be very transparent with you, Bill. I do not believe that the city is managing our homeless problem as effectively as we should be. We have been, through my office, we've been advocating for three things for the last couple of years, none of which the mayor and the rest of the council have embraced yet. One would have directly addressed what happened over at Mountain and Fort Lowell, and that is what are called structured camps or controlled camps. And what you do is, and other jurisdictions are doing, this is not something that Steve Kozachik invented, is that you identify areas that are not next to residential, not next to businesses, and you allow a limited amount of camping, 15, 20, 25 people. You provide them with a water source, you know, hand cleaning station. You provide them with a port-a-john. You make sure that the social service agencies are going by there daily, offering people the services that they may need. And you make sure that the police are going by there daily to make sure that it's not turning into simply an area where people are conducting open-air drug use or domestic violence or something like that. There are reasons that I don't agree with that the city has not embraced that yet. I am right now working with a couple of the other council members on how to bring that idea to the city council. We are following what's called a Housing First model. Housing First means that we're going to go out and buy a bunch of hotels and find you a room at the inn when it's available. But understand, people who are chronically homeless, who are strung out on opioids, who may have a serious mental illness, they're not going to thrive in an apartment setting. And so we have to provide a transitional option, which is what these structured camps would be, so that when they get stabilized and when we have room, we can move them into that. I'm not suggesting these as a permanent housing option, but I'm suggesting that as a transitional way that we can get people out of people's backyards and into a controlled camp area so that we don't have this. You know, it's a kind of vigilante, we'll deal with it ourselves approach to life.
You know, in this environment, cutting trees in Tucson, Arizona, I have to tell you, it turns my stomach. When I saw that article, the front page of the paper, at least 75 trees, it's just really sad.
It's sad and it's stupid because they didn't solve anything.
No.
All they did is they transferred a problem to an adjacent neighborhood. And so if we want to get serious about addressing homelessness, and I will give the guys who cut the trees down the benefit of the doubt that they did want to deal with the homeless issue. They didn't do it productively. And so work with us on finding solutions, and don't just exacerbate the problem by shifting it to another location. And oh, by the way, cutting down a 75 tree grove that had been growing in that and nurtured by those same residents for years.
That must make the people that have been nurturing them more than sick.
Oh yeah, they're pretty ticked, and so that neighborhood association is having some internal, call it squabbling, going on right now.
So what happens?
As they should.
What happens to these people? Were determined that's going to be determined whether actual criminal charges will be filed against the perpetrators.
Criminal charges are a possibility. That's something that the city attorney is looking into right now. Who funded it? Who actually went out and did it? I'll give you an example. We had a similar situation in Palo Verde neighborhood about 3 years ago where it had nothing to do with homelessness, but some guy just took it upon himself to go down and start chopping down trees. We identified him, and he was criminally prosecuted, and I think the fine that coming out of the courts was something in the neighborhood of $40,000 for criminal damage. Yeah. So this is not over. The conversation is not over. To their credit, Tucson Clean and Beautiful has offered to ante up trees to help replace them. And I've already spoken to Kevin Dahl and saying if he's a ward member in that area. And I've said if you need any help from a funding standpoint, we'll pitch in out of the Ward 6 office too.
All right. Well, that's a step in the right direction. Let's pause right here with Steve Kasachek. We'll talk about Mona's Danish Bakery, which is always a pleasure to talk about Mona's. We love them. They're at the northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. Steve and the team do just a beautiful job, and they do a great job at lunch as well. So it's not just about breakfast, although you can have breakfast at any time, but the lunch is ready right now. Mona'sDanishBakery.com is their website. They open the doors at 6:30 in the morning, and they take Monday off. Other than that, they're ready for you. They're ready for you right now. Again, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise for Mona's Danish Bakery, which, of course, is home of the Danish Kringle. We'll be right back on Buckmaster Midweek Edition. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan to the RTA board by December. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Thinking about a river cruise? Let Bon Voyage Travel guide you to choose the perfect cruise to complement your vacation dreams. River cruising has become more popular than ever, and we know you have so many options to consider when selecting the destination, cruise line, and ship. At Bon Voyage Travel, we provide a comprehensive presentation on the top tips for river cruises and have a team of specialists to assist you. Visit bvtravel.com and view our River Cruise 101 presentation today.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show and the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studios. Our live line, our telephone interviews presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. Let's go back on the live line. The Ward 6 Democrat Councilman Steve Kasachek. Steve, I see that you and Councilman Dahl teamed up on a micro grid proposal. What's that all about? And was the council open to this?
Yeah, so microgrid is a solar array that is decoupled from the large TEP grid. It is used all over the world as a power source, that I have worked, I've reached out to TEP and want to work with them on this to help reduce the load on the TEP grid. So by setting up a series of microgrids to power certain things for the city-owned buildings right now around town. We had a study session yesterday. The council agreed to move forward with a pilot project, kind of following the, you know, the take baby steps first approach, and to demonstrate the viability and the economic viability of the concept. We are going to begin a pilot program out at the Donna Liggins Recreation Center. It is one of our cooling stations. We have one in each ward. Donna Liggins is in Ward 3. And I proposed that because during the monsoon season that just happened, I think it was about 2 months ago when Donna Liggins was hit with a little microburst and all their power went out. Well, it's one of our cooling stations, and so it doesn't do people much good when your cooling station is without electricity for a series of 3 or 4 days. So what we're proposing is let's set up a microgrid there so that if that were to happen again, we're building resiliency into that facility, demonstrating a couple of things. Number one, that we do not have to be tied to the TEP grid in order to keep providing a cooling station and those amenities to people. Number two, by doing that, we are reducing the drain and the draw on the TEP grid so that during the extra hot parts of day and in the evening when people are tapping into the TEP grid, we're not doing it. We're powering those facilities by using the microgrid. And I'm hopeful that we can get TEP on board with it because I think to the extent that, you know, we can start building these in scattered sites around town, then everybody benefits. A couple of the other areas that are ripe. First of all, I'd like to see we have a cooling center in each ward, one in each ward. I think we ought to be doing one of these microgrids to cool those centers. So for the obvious reason that we don't repeat what just happened at Donna Liggins next monsoon. We also have water pumping stations. You see them scattered around town. It takes electricity to pump water. God help us if we wind up losing the ability to pump water during a power outage for a series of days. Now, some of our water stations have a diesel backup, but not all of them do. So that's another example of where we might put these. Another is we have these EV charging stations that the city is now requiring. A microgrid could power those as well. So there are ways that we can help private sector. We can help TEP and build more resiliency into the city. They're not cheap. There are federal grants coming. I know the city is right now applying for a series of federal grants in the area of environmental sustainability, and microgrids would absolutely be candidates for being funded with some federal dollars to help kickstart some of these initiatives. I'm hoping that this pilot demonstrates to the city that, you know, that they're, number one, they're environmentally valuable, number two, they're economically, they make sense, and finally, we would get TEP involved so that we can build these in a fashion that they can either be decoupled from or coupled to the grid so that in certain times of day, TEP could actually be drawing power off of them as well when their own grid gets challenged because of the excessive heat that we see. So lots of upside to it. They are costly, but we're going to take a small step first, and I'm confident that we'll demonstrate the viability of them. And where else but in the Southwest, right?
Yep. How about the plastic recycling project? What's the update on that?
We have our service agreement with Bifusion. It's in place. The city right now has begun design on the facility for Bifusion. It will be out at the Los Reales Sustainability Campus out on the west side. The Bifusion is our, well, in fact, I'll be meeting with them later today. Bifusion is ordering the parts and pieces to the blocker machine. That's going to be their part in this thing, and they will, once they get up and running in Tucson, and I'm hopeful about mid next year that we will be able to generate process roughly 40 tons per month of non-recyclable plastics. I am really hoping that they get here sooner rather than later, because we are by the minute continuing to gather more plastic, and so we're bumping 200 tons of this stuff right now, and we're siphoning off bits of it, trucking it over to California, so they're making blocks. But from a sustainability and an environmental standpoint, that's obviously not ideal, to be driving to California and recycling the stuff back to Tucson. So getting them up and running in Tucson is the ultimate goal. But it's going to happen. We've got the agreement in place. We're building them a facility. They're building the machine. And now it's just pulling all the pieces together. The one challenging long lead item, and since I mentioned TEP earlier, I'll mention them again, is that the longest lead time item for the blocker machine is a power panel and a transformer. So I've already reached out to TEP. I've invited them to be participants in our design meetings with Bifusion. We have to get the thing up and running, and we can't be sitting waiting on TEP to come clean with a transformer and an electrical panel, because we're going to get buried in the plastic if we don't get them here as quickly as possible.
We had a listener just send me an email. I didn't know that the solar technology, 90% of it is built in China. I don't know if that's true, but you would think that we would start to get our own sourcing here in this country, Steve Kasachek.
Absolutely. There's no reason for us not to be a player in that market. I mean, there are lots of different bits and pieces to that. I mean, the battery technology that requires lithium and some mined materials. You know, I don't know where in the United States we're mining that, but it's going to be a natural resource that we need to stand up that industry. I do know that the solar arrays, there are domestic manufacturers of the solar arrays, so pieces of it. And I don't know the percentage, pieces of it are coming from overseas, but pieces of it are coming domestically too. And we have a president right now who keeps espousing all things environmental and all things sustainable. Then they need to start walking that talk and standing up some domestic businesses so that we're not subservient to international trade markets and the vagaries of that when we need some of the bits and pieces to start building some of these arrays.
We talked a little bit about the homeless issue. You're not exactly happy with the way the Housing First approach to it. Is there some movement on the council toward what you had said about perhaps these kind of limited, controlled homeless camps?
Well, I hope there is, and I say it that way because, quite bluntly, the mayor does not support the notion, but we need to get some council members who will stand up and say, look, what we're doing right now is not working. It's working for a small percentage of the homeless population. We have housed roughly 650 people through the Housing First model. That's great for those 650 people. But we have 2,000 or 3,000 who are right now in your backyard or in washes or under bridges who need a different approach. One of the challenges that we have is even defining the term homeless. I mean, is that the 15 or 16-year-old kid who just got kicked out of a foster home? Or is it the 75-year-old person who just had a catastrophic illness and is out on the street for the first time in their life? I mean, clearly the modalities that you would employ to address those two people are far different. One might make it in a shelter, one will not. One might make it in an apartment, one will not. So we have to be flexible enough in our approach to this national problem. Locally, we have to be flexible enough so that we're offering a menu of options and not simply planting our flag in the Housing First model and saying, this is all we're going to offer. It's expensive. It has some strictures that many of the homeless people cannot or do not want to adhere to. And that's why I'm hopeful that the couple of council members that I'm working with right now will get the fortitude and stand up and say, we got to try something different, because what we're doing now is simply not working for the majority of the homeless population in Tucson, and therefore it's not working for the majority of the residents in Tucson.
It's certainly not a one-size-fits-all approach, is it,
no,
to the situation?
No.
Yeah.
No, and the fastest growing demographic of homelessness that we have right now in the city are seniors. And that may seem counterintuitive, but we have had two homeless women dropped off at Sister Jose Women's Shelter who were discharged prematurely by a local hospital. You know, one still had a stent in her. And the reason is because the hospitals needed the bed space, and so they dropped them off at a homeless shelter. These women aren't going to survive on a street. We have people who are strung out on fentanyl. They're not going to make it in a housing first model. We need to get them stabilized first. We have people with serious mental illnesses. They need to be in a stable environment, and they're not going to thrive in a hotel setting or a motel setting. So you're exactly right. It is not one size fits all. The modalities that we need to employ to address people's needs are all across the board. You know, the young kid, the domestic violence victim, the meth addict, the SMI, serious mental illness person, the senior, the veteran with PTSD, they all need a different kind of approach. And so to try and rely on one model is simply not recognizing or not acknowledging that homelessness is a complex issue, and therefore it needs a complex array of solutions being offered to the people who are suffering from it.
Thank you very much, Steve Kasachek. Have a great afternoon.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show and the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. It is our midweek edition. You know, Green Things is ready for you to do this is the transition season. There's no doubt about it. This was a brutal summer, not only with the heat, but the hail. We had two major hailstorms. Some of the plants just took a real beating. So now would be a great time to do some replacement. Go out to Green Things. things, and they will certainly point you in the right direction to some beautiful color for the garden. 3384 East River Road. It's a very pretty area. It's right there by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. They've got 13 acres. Not only all the plant activity, but then they have Zocalo Village. It's a nice complement to their business, Zocalo Village, with the beautiful Talavera pottery, the beautiful handcrafted dining room sets, and some beautiful items imported really from all over the world. So check it out, greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. When we do our telephone interviews, our live line, presented by our friends at Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. It's always a pleasure to welcome our contributor. We have 24 contributors to this radio show. I'm so proud of each of them, and they just have excelled in their field. They're at the top in their field. Dr. Jeffrey Silvertooth, our contributor on agriculture, is with me in studio. He's been busy this summer. We haven't really touched base for a couple of months. We try to bring him in about every 4 to 6 weeks, so we were a little bit tardy this time, but both of us had different things going on, but we're glad he's back with us. He's professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science in the Department of Environmental Science at the University of Arizona. He served on the faculty at the University of Arizona and worked statewide since 1987. That's a year before I returned to Tucson, so it's like Jeff and I did not get off the bus yesterday. Let's put it that way. Dr. Silvertooth is recognized as a fellow for both the American Society of Agronomy and Soil Science Society of America. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Very good. Thank you, Bill. How are you?
Hanging in there. It's good to have you back. The Saudi Arabian owned farm in Arizona is really, it's garnering a lot of headlines. And now there is action from the governor. Governor Hobbs said she's going to protect Arizona's water future by saying that this Arizona farm, which has been growing alfalfa for export, is going to lose its lease to access to state land in Arizona. What's the backstory, Jeff, to this?
Well,
and are there other foreign-owned landowners in Arizona that you know of? Maybe that's my follow-up to you after you tell us about the history of this place.
Well, there are a lot of factors impinging on this one issue, and I think one part of it is that we should consider right off the bat in discussing that is what you, the second part of your question,
yeah,
is that are there other companies or other foreign interests that have land in Arizona? Absolutely. Based on a USDA database that was running from 2016 to 2020, which I believe is the most recent data that's available, there were 27 foreign countries.
I did not know
that. Own land, principally ag land in Arizona.
Wow.
They own about 1.5 million acres in Arizona. 27 other countries. Now, the number one country,
yeah,
according to that database, the USDA database, yeah, owning land, ag land in Arizona, Switzerland.
Really?
Yeah, Switzerland owned about 250,000 acres in Arizona. Excuse me, about 440,000 acres in Arizona. That was Switzerland. Almost 500,000 acres of ag land. Most of that is in Maricopa County. Now, that's probably a pretty good investment for them. Anybody.
Why would the Swiss, is that going back to this alfalfa deal?
Not really.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
I would speculate. They're looking at urban growth in Maricopa County.
Oh.
Ag land is going out, and
yeah,
and urban development's going in all over that county. It's massive.
Okay.
It's
okay.
Massive. So it's probably a pretty good investment. Matter of fact, if you and I had ag land in Maricopa County, we'd probably stand to make quite a bit of money on,
yeah,
that in the next several years,
yeah,
as that development increases. The second country, number two in that ranking, was Mexico.
Huh.
And they're the ones that have about 260,000 acres of ag land. Most of that's grazing land, range land. And way down the list is Saudi Arabia. According to this database, when it was collected, they had about 440 acres, 440.
440?
Yeah, compared to like 440,000 that Switzerland had.
Uh-huh.
So the point is this, is there's lots of foreign countries, foreign entities, I should say, that have investments in the United States. So I have a friend that works in the real estate business, commercial real estate, and they were saying, as an example, the Chinese own most of downtown Los Angeles.
Wow.
Now, most Americans aren't aware of this.
No.
And there's another angle to this as well. Now, I'm not trying to make a case in defense of the Saudis, but I'm trying to make a case in the sense of equity and being open-minded about this. I mean, looking at the full picture and the fact that we have lots of foreign entities that have investments in the United States, and Arizona included. Now, second, a part of that there too, Bill, is that we export a lot of things out of this country, and we export a lot of crops. Mm-hmm. So it's like if the Saudis, and they aren't breaking any laws, mm-hmm. You know, and so if you want to pick on them directly, well, then you've got 27 other countries and foreign entities, I should say, that have interests have investment interest in agricultural land and land in Arizona. So where do you stop on that?
And I wonder how many of those countries though are using water like the Saudis.
Well, that's a good question too. A good question too is other companies come in here, and we champion those companies that come in with manufacturing. They might be U.S. owned or international corporations.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And about they're going to use new business coming, and we
Just take the microchip business.
How much water do they use?
A lot.
I didn't
a
know.
A lot. Yeah. And those chips go all over the world. Now we don't holler about that.
No.
No, but it's when you drive down I-10 and you see water going out on the land, and there's the Saudi Arabians and the whole deal there, I think that accentuates an emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so all I'm saying is that I think as we look at this, we need to look at it, I think, logically, objectively, and you need to think about what are the legal ramifications in a broad spectrum sense, not just with the Saudis and this one farm. Now, granted, they're using a lot of water, but so are a lot of other farms like that, you know?
And why? Because alfalfa uses a lot of water?
Alfalfa is a perennial crop. We irrigate it all year long, and it produces a lot of dry matter, produces a lot of material.
Okay.
We use that material here primarily, that alfalfa, the forage crops that we grow to feed cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And we feed those cattle in Arizona primarily because we have these large dairy and feedlot operations here because Arizonans want dairy products, and we want meat products.
Mm-hmm.
So the Saudis, in their case, they want dairy and meat. They can't grow alfalfa very well in their country anymore.
No.
And so they're going around the world. Now, what we see happening all around the world is what we're calling agricultural colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much happening in the United States as it is in other countries. I would say China, for example, has huge investments in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And huge investments in Africa with regard to what they're basically saying. They're running out of land, over a billion people in China, and they're looking for land and resources to support them. I think this is a coming thing in the future. You know, I don't know if you want to get into this today or not, but it's a coming thing of the future we have to think about. With limited resources, a warming, drying climate, and a growing population. And the pressures are coming down. Other countries are looking around. Where around in the world can we go and legally secure lands, secure resources, and produce food for our people? So I think we as Arizonans and as Americans, if we have think about anything from this, we should start thinking about, okay, if you want to start saving these resources for the long-term future, well, then what is that plan? What is the strategic investment we have for land and for agriculture, for our country, for today, and very importantly, for the future?
How can we just tell Saudi Arabia, though, that we're going to just not end your lease? I mean, is that legal? Or,
well, I'm not an attorney.
I know.
But I wouldn't want to be.
Imagine the legal power of the Saudi Arabians?
Well, I mean, just anybody. I mean, that's why you go back again. All right, how about these other 27? Are they breaking any laws?
I don't know. No.
None? How can you pick them out and do that? I would think that's pretty thin ice, figuratively speaking, to get out on legally. You know, that's what our governor and our state government's doing right now. I'm not going to second guess them necessarily, but I would say I have some questions about that, very, very much in line with yours. Is that legal?
Yeah.
Can you do that?
Do you know this area called the Butler Valley in Western Arizona?
Yeah. Sure. Yes.
Yeah,
sir.
And that's a heavy alfalfa growing area then?
Well, in this one area where they have this well field.
Okay.
It's groundwater they're pulling from to do this. And this one area, this has been developed for that purpose, yes.
All right.
And it was Americans that had it before. Americans primarily developed it. And then they sold the land, and it happened to be just like this other land selling. A foreign entity came in this case, the Saudis, picked it up and bought it for their own purposes.
All right, we'll take a break right here. More with Josh Silvertooth as we continue on the Buckmaster Show, Midweek Edition. Be right back.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. on the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority Plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is collected throughout Pima County and averages more than $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Look at that midday temperature. I love it over in Silver City. 74 degrees. So overnight low is going to be actually in the upper 40s. So autumn, perfect time of year to get over to the Land of Enchantment. Silver City is only about a three-hour drive. Check out their website before you make the trip, southwestnewmexico.org. I think you'll be very surprised about so many activities, mainly outdoors. The Gila Cliff Dwellings National Monument is there, the Gila National Forest. There's a lot going on over there, and it's not a bad trip at all, about 3 hours east of Tucson. All right, Jeff Silvertooth is with us, our contributor on agriculture, and we're welcoming Jeff back to the show. He's had a very busy summer. He's professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science in the Department of Environmental Science at the University of Arizona. Jeff, I was reading an article about one gentleman who's a legal scholar about the Colorado River. He says the Colorado River Basin is the canary in the mine for the future of water in the American West. I think that sounds about right.
I do too. Well, of course, we live in that basin, and we deal with the issues associated with Colorado, but I do think it's emblematic of our water issues in the West. And it reminds me, I go back to Wallace Stegner's book, Beyond the 100th Meridian, and it's basically about John Wesley Powell, his explorations of the West in the 19th century. He's the famous one-armed Civil War veteran that went down the Colorado River.
In the early 1870s or something.
Right, somewhere like 1869.
But he had one arm?
Yeah, he had one arm. He lost an arm at Shiloh in the Civil War, the Battle of Shiloh. He was a Union officer. He survived the war, but then went out west, and basically his explorations in the West put a pretty strong impression on him about the limitations of water.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a famous statement to the Montana Congress during the formation of their state constitution, where he's saying the ultimate value of the American Western territories will be measured in terms of acre feet.
Mm.
And that was in like 1889. And it's
boy, did he nail that.
He sure nailed that. And he's, of course, he was a champion of that cause in the Colorado River Basin. So this legal scholar that you make reference to today is basically, I think, right on track. What we're realizing is the prophetic truth of what John Wesley Powell pointed out. And I think the Colorado River is emblematic of the Western water situation.
And if we don't fix what is broken with that river, we're in trouble.
We have to deal with it. Mother Nature basically has reduced the flow from about 15 million acre feet a year down to about 12.3 since 2000. And what we have to do is we have a simple mass balance. We can't be trying to pull more water out. We've been able to do so because we're having a savings account in those reservoirs. And we've drawn them down to about 30% reservoirs of Powell and Lake Mead, on the Colorado River primarily. There's big storage reservoirs. So we have to get ourselves in balance, a mass balance with what Mother Nature's sending down the river. Some of the scientists that are studying global change, global climate change, are suggesting that what we need to get ready for is basically a flow of about 9 million acre feet in that river. So we have water to support people. We just can't be overusing it. We have to bring ourselves within the means of what we actually have available to us. And I think that's the story all over the West. It's tough because we've really populated, particularly in the Southwest. We've got 40 million people living on this water with the Colorado River. It's also emblematic because we have put a lot of pressure on it. It's also very productive. It's much more productive than the lower basin, for example, and the Colorado River is much more productive than the agriculture, particularly than the upper basin.
And you're talking about for the California farmers.
Yes, sir. You know, I should back that up, Bill. It's a good point. They being the Bureau of Reclamation, and this was done in a 1922 compact, divide the river in upper and lower basins, the Colorado River. The division point is at Lee's Ferry, just below Lake Powell.
Mm-hmm.
And the dam, and right above the Grand Canyon, right at Lee's Ferry. So above that is considered as upper basin, below that is considered as lower basin. Lower basin is Arizona, California, Nevada, and of course Mexico fits in with us as well.
Are they going to have to, this inherited legal right that the Imperial County California farmers have to the Colorado River, are they under pressure to give up some of those legal rights, and will they do it?
Everybody's under pressure to give up legal rights. This last year when we were going through, the commission from the Colorado River was going through the negotiations of how to deal with this drought. There's lots of finger pointing. Everybody's pointing at everybody else. The lower basin and the upper basin are really at odds. And California is at odds sometimes with the whole outfit because they have the largest allocation of anyone. It's primarily the Imperial Valley. 3.1 million acre feet is allocated to the Imperial Valley. Now, they have the oldest grandfathered rights. They did it legally.
From 1920, right?
Yeah, I think before that even.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir. And the Palo Verde Valley of California and the Yuma Valley of Arizona are the top three. They have priority one levels because the way the law reads, if you were here first and you perfected those water rights at the time of acquisition back in the 19th century, early 20th century, those things, that holds forward in what we call the law of the river, which is an amalgam of laws and contracts, agreements, treaties that have been established over the past 120 years. And California has those rights. Now, there's a lot of question that people had in the last year. Maybe we should throw all that away and rebuild the whole law of the river body. Well, that's going to be a tough deal. You're going to go into lawsuits, think. In a way, the law.
Can you imagine?
At the time, the river will dry. All of us will be, I don't know, all of us will dry up by the time that gets solved.
Yeah.
And so I look at it as that we're going to have to see people get into these chambers the next couple of years as they work out these new agreements on the Colorado River and a lot of other western rivers, particularly the Colorado, and work out some agreements among the states.
This is the other shoe that could be dropping. You know, the question, are we going to have to limit manufacturing facilities in the western states, and are we going to have to somehow limit the growth of, I don't know how you stop people from moving here, but what about the growth being limited?
Well, one thing that I think that's you talk about the 70% of the water in the state of Arizona, and more than 70% of the water in the Colorado River Basin is going to agriculture. That's why we're talking about it. And so one of the biggest concerns that goes on out there is that agriculture probably is going to have to, is already taken. Of all the water reductions that have happened in Arizona, it's primarily agriculture that's given up that water. So you look ahead to the future, and it's probably agriculture will give up most of that water. And the pressures are out there to do so. I mean, look at those 40 million people, large cities like Los Angeles, Phoenix, Tucson, et cetera, Las Vegas. And What are you going to do about that? You've got to take care of these populations. That's going to be a priority.
But legally, can you go after the farmers and make them give up their water rights? You can't do that, can you?
They can, but you go back to those priorities. And that's what's happened here. The Central Arizona farmers lost their water off the Central Arizona project, which comes from the Colorado River, because they were lowest priority.
Yeah.
So they start chopping that out. A lot of ag waters are lower priorities, and we're gonna pull it back. Well, we've already pretty well done. It's pulled it back to the main stem of the Colorado River, where the agriculture is taking place. So we're looking at the lower basin primarily. The lower basin, those would be the valleys in Arizona, California, and Las Vegas takes all their water from the Nevada allocation. So probably there's where the push will come first. But and the other thing, too, you ask about population development. Mm-hmm. There's several people that are strong advocates of saying you need to commercialize water like a commodity, and you make it more expensive, and that will start restricting growth in its own sense. But mm-hmm. that's a hypothetical right now.
So we had a little bit of a reprieve. I understand we've got some water levels that did come up a little mm-hmm. bit.
Right.
So push the can down the road a little bit.
That's exactly what's happened. Yeah, we had a good winter water-wise.
Yeah.
We had good snowpack, good snow melt, and a good return to those reservoirs. So the reservoirs came up, and that's exactly what happened, Bill. It gave us a little breathing room. And now this commission that's negotiating these water rights on the Colorado River have been able to kind of kick the can down the road, like you say. But it gives them 2 years to come to these negotiations, because in 2026, all those rules come to an end with regard to the drought contingency plans and drought management, and that has to be redone. So that's the next 2 years are where the river is going to really meet the road on
and
all this.
Since I have seen you and you've been with us, the Supreme Court made a ruling against the Navajo Nation.
They did, and that was based on what the Navajos were asking for, and the Supreme Court basically determined that the treaty agreement, I think from 1848 or something like that did not specifically say that they had allocations at rights to Colorado River water. Now, the federal government has a commitment to work with the Navajos with regard to water provisions, so they didn't specifically say Colorado River water. So they ruled against the Navajos, or in that case, Navajos lost that bid for Colorado River water, but that still remains that we have seven states and one other and two nations that are vying for that water, and there are plenty of straws in the tank already. But the Navajo Nation case was decided by the Supreme Court that they did not have legal rights to the Colorado River per se.
So they don't get Colorado River water?
They get some out of the Little Colorado River, so they take some out of the basin. And I don't know exactly how those water rights all work out, but they're asking for more water off the main stem of the Colorado.
All right, Jeff Silvertooth, always a lot to talk with you about, and we'll look forward to your next visit in about a month. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
On behalf of Professor Silvertooth and Tom, who always does a great job engineering and producing the Buckmaster Show, I am Bill Buckmaster, and everybody here wishes everyone out there well. Have a great day.